Say, be everybody else, can't you see?
Now, ain't that the truth? That's the legendary folk singer, Odetta, with her original composition, Hit or Miss. This appeared on her 1970 album, Odetta Sings. Tom Jones, in honor of Odetta, did a great version of the song on his 2012 album, Spirits in the Room. Odetta, born Odetta Holmes in Birmingham, Alabama, was one of several artists who not only revived folk music in the United States, but made it synonymous with the human rights and anti-war and labor union movements of the 1960s and 70s. In fact, Rosa Parks and Dr. King said that she was one of their favorites, and Bob Dylan credited her with actually inculcating in him an interest in folk music. Odetta died in New York City on December the 31st, 2008, at the age of 77. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and you know today is Free Your Mind Friday. This is our freewheeling open forum where opinions and ideas aren't just part of the program, they are the program, the entire show. So I encourage you and I invite you to do so. Bring your unique perspectives on the issues of the day or any other subject that you believe might be of interest or would warrant further discussion and debate to the gathering place right here on Free Your Mind Friday. Call 888-874-4888 and declare your own independence of thought. Okay, so there we are. It's been quite a week, and it's just not stopping. You know, every now and then you hope and pray for a little lull, that things would kind of calm down a little bit and you can stitch together again the remnants or the tattered pieces of your mind, and it just doesn't stop. It just keeps going along. So let's hear what you have to think about things, where they're going, where we're going. And there's no right or wrong, as you know. We just talk here on this program. And we engage in a kind of conversation that says, this is what's on my mind. What do you think? And people relate to each other on that basis. Well, we have up first Joel from New York. Hello, Joel. How are you doing?
Hi, Eutrice.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very, very well, thanks. I hope you're fine, too.
I'm hanging in here. I'm doing fine.
Excellent. Excellent. Wonderful programs this week, by the way.
Thank you.
Just terrific. So, as I recall, last week I laid the hammer to El Comandante Bernie, and got a lot of flack from people who are listening to the show who I'm in touch with. But that's all right. So today what I think I'd like to do is to go after another venerable icon, Noam Chomsky. And I should say off the bat that I have a lot of respect for Chomsky. And I might say personally that when I was 19 years old, just before I was getting a little autobiographic right now, so I apologize, just before I was entering my second season to register voters in the Mississippi Delta, 1962, I attended my first anti-war demonstration. It was at the Times Square Recruiting Center in June of 1962. I'll never forget it. There were about 10 of us there who were protesting Kennedy's dropping of 500-pound bombs on the Vietnamese Delta in South Vietnam, an act of war. And Chomsky was there, and that was the first time I ever met him. And, you know, he certainly has been one of the great dissidents of our time. He's been doing it for 50 years, and often he's been a lone wolf. I mean, his book that he wrote with Edward Herman, Manufacturing Consent, is really one of the more important works of nonfiction in the 20th century, and he has really molded many minds. So that said, I want to go after him, primarily because, and this, I guess, connects with what I had to say last week, he has been a kind of living refutation of the independence of radical politics when it comes to presidential elections. He continually supports the lesser evil argument and has done so since the Kerry election of 2004. And it seems to me that Hillary Clinton is a living refutation of the logic of lesser evilism. Since her candidacy as the most right-wing Democratic nominee since Harry A. Bond Truman, is really the most inevitable consequence of decades of lesser evil voting. And this kind of toxic political pragmatism, they love to call themselves pragmatists, engenders a process of a kind of, you know, it's like natural selection in reverse, where the candidates get more and more retrograde because their opponents can always be painted as fractionally more odious. So, you know, let's each pick our own poison in the privacy of the voting booth. You know, a vote for Hillary Clinton isn't my main problem with Chomsky's argument. I think the most noxious element of the argument of the endorsement of Clinton is his paternalistic guilt-tripping that seeks to blame people who choose to vote for Jill Stein or Gloria Lariva or Gary Johnson, no one at all, in the extremely unlikely event that Trump prevails in November. And if Clinton, who now enjoys the support from both the, as I would call it, the Chomsky wing of the Democrats and the Kissinger-Goldman Sachs wing of the GOP, manages to lose, it will be the fault of her own record of mendaciousness and villainy. Just as Gore was solely responsible for blowing the 2000 election, even though liberals continue to viciously scapegoat Nader, Ralph Nader. And so it's an intellectually dishonest position and a morally indefensible one.
So in this regard, then, how do you interpret Elizabeth Warren?
Oh, well, you know, she used to be a Republican about 6 or 7 years ago before she decided to become a Wall Street reformer. And I don't deny that she has integrity when she was, you know, head of the, what was the name of the commission now? The Commodity Futures Commission. I don't deny that, you know, she had great integrity there. But the fact is that she, you know, is running around with Clinton now. She's endorsed her. And also, I've had problems with her in the past. She, back when she was first got into the Senate, she supported Obama's $200 million arms supplement to the Israelis when they were destroying Gaza the last time in 2014. And she's a big Zionist, and she supports the imperial project. So enough of her. So it seems to me that the position that all of these people take is intellectually dishonest and really morally indefensible. For instance, Chomsky wouldn't bear any responsibility for the deaths caused by, let's say, the candidate that they support, that she supports. But Greens, anarchists, and socialists, and anti-war libertarians who recoil from Lady Macbeth would bear responsibility for the carnage caused by the candidate Trump they did not support. And to me, that's a textbook case of moral hypocrisy. And, you know, I've been looking at some Shakespeare lately, and I was the other night I was looking at Henry I, and there's a great quote from Shakespeare that I have in my head, and I've had in my head for a number of years that I think applies here, where he says that Henry I ate a surfeit of lampreys, which mortally chilled the old man's blood and caused a sudden and violent illness against which nature struggled, unquote. And it seems to me that Chomsky has a sturdy constitution, but these days it pays to be prudent. So it's...
But aren't you... Aren't you engaging in the blame of letting Chomsky basically take a hit for all similarly situated individuals? Are you saying, in effect, that he epitomizes this class of individuals, or are you being specific about Chomsky?
Well, I think both, because he has so much intellectual influence over people like you and me, and many like us, that certainly many are going to listen very carefully to what he says, but it's also a position that he is taking on his own. You know, and I want to say that it doesn't absolve Chomsky from, even though he's done so many wonderful things in his life and important things, from affixing his name to an ethically bankrupt argument. Because that is now being made by Hillary's new friends, George Will, who's supporting her, Henry Kissinger and his protege, Richard Armitage, Brent Scowcroft, and one of the men who brought you the 2008 financial crash, Henry Paulson. So, pulling Shakespeare again, it's a confederacy of lampreys indeed. He is, in effect, you know, I'm not saying that Chomsky, in effect, is a counter-revolutionary, but he is taking a position that is so morally and so hurtful that I think it has to be pointed out, even though it's Noam Chomsky.
I think you are correct, and I agree with you 100% on this. When our ambassadors or the people that we admire take positions that are quite adverse to positions they had taken before, you not only begin to suspect that they're losing it in terms of their focus and their history. They've been historically people who have been the watchdogs, if you will, and they have called out the enemy. But you see, in so many ways, we see a silence about Hillary Clinton. It's in the feminist movement. A lot of women who should be speaking up loudly. I mean, just yesterday we talked about the kidnapping in Nigeria of almost 300 girls, the displacement of more than 2 million people, many of them, of course, most of them, women and children. We talk about the devastating impact of the State Department's policies and the foreign policy of the United States in the slaughter of women and children in Africa and parts beyond. But we don't see the feminists stepping forward and questioning how could we possibly support a person like this. We don't see that discussion. Elizabeth Warren, the so-called conscience of the Senate, is, I mean, they like a team, and she has dismissed every indication that she ought to be raising questions right now about Hillary Clinton. And this consistent record of you know, shady dealings. And
you
wonder what is accounting for the fact that they suddenly cannot see and they suddenly do not know this side of Hillary.
Yeah.
But thanks for bringing that to our attention.
Say,
you want to finish up?
One last little thing.
Yes.
And that is that, you know, a lot of these politicians, Warren, I think, is an exception, because she's really being hypocritical because she knows the difference. But Chomsky certainly knows his history. He's written it. He's written it, for God's sake. So that's why I'm particularly distressed that he continues along this line.
Well, I'm not distressed that he would function that way. I remember a major issue occurred within Pacifica in which Noam Chomsky, who never, ever, ever called me, never spoke to me, never ascertained facts from the other side, and he's a historian, that's what historians are supposed to do, took a position and continues to take a position in which he should be questioning his own actions, but he didn't. A whole lot of people did that because the central figure was a white female. And he decided that he was going to automatically accept everything she said was absolutely true. The evidence has since shown that it is far from true. But he has never apologized. He's still never called me. And I said to myself then, wow, if this is the kind of history that you do, I think I'll look for other sources from now on. But
you know,
I don't deny his value at all. He's done a great deal of work. But again, it's very, very hard to basically overcome conditioning that says in a situation you don't have to talk to people. You don't have to ask questions.
The reason why I brought this up, Utrecht, is because in an interview recently, he said referencing this issue that the left is beginning to self-destruct. And I just couldn't let that pass, even if it is Noam Chomsky.
Thank you so much for your call today.
Okay.
Jose
right,
from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor.
Hello, Jose. How are you?
Fine. It's great to hear your voice.
Thank you.
As always,
and same here.
Thank you. As always, ancestral blessing be upon you. Always.
Thank you.
Now, you know, I'm an elder who I'm always curious. And my mother always told us that we're never too old to learn. And I'm going up in age, but I still want to learn. I try in every way I get to learn. And what better teacher than yourself? So, I would like
no pressure at all on me.
Well, I have enough confidence in you, so don't worry about that. I trust you. I trust your judgment and your intellect. Now, in light of what has been happening in Puerto Rico, all right? And we have seen it happen in Greece and many other parts of the underdeveloped and the developing world. And, you know, sometimes I think that those are precursors for the things that are to come in the United States. We have seen it, things start to happen in Britain and there's movement in other parts of Europe and so forth. But, you know, I'm an island person and I like to think island. Because I believe that most of the things that happens in the islands, in these underdeveloped and these small nations that believe that they're developing, it is only a mirror of what we in the industrialized world, who feel so snug and in this so-called democracy that they're living under, and this wealth and opulence, they believe that the things that are befalling these small nations is not coming to them. It's just that it is delayed. It is on its way. But most of our folks tend to look at those small nations and just say it is those people and not us, not realizing that our days are coming. So the thing I'm looking at is my little island there, Jamaica, right? Jamaica is busy building all kind of highways and byways all over the island, right? And the hotels, the French and the Spanish and the Americans and the British and whatever, they are building hotels all over Jamaica. And these highways, when these highways are built, they are toll roads. And most of the poor folks are the ones that's going to have to pay for these tolls. And when I look and I see, I compare what is happening to in Jamaica to what is happening, what has happened in places like Hawaii and so forth, because I always like to say that we are witnessing the Hawaiianization of Jamaica. Because where are all these hotels? The only thing that's going down there now is hotels, highways, superhighways, real estate. When I look and I see properties in Jamaica and houses that's being built, these overpriced condominiums and houses that's being built in Jamaica, and these hustlers have to come to American and Canada and so forth, where the diaspora are and so forth, to try to sell them these houses because the natives can't afford these houses. When I look and I see Remax and all these other big real estate, American real estate companies are selling our properties all over Jamaica. And when I go down to Jamaica and I look, when I was a child growing up, the commerce of Jamaica was in the hands, deep in the hands of Jewish immigrants, Syrians and the other Europeans and so forth. And now I see many decades have passed. I'm an old man now. And when I go to Jamaica and I look, when I go into these stores, yes, some of them have our people working in them. But when they take the money from you, they take it to a section where the new wave of Chinese are there taking the funds, the lifeblood of the commerce, industrial, the commerce of the country is in the hands of others. And none of our people are there replacing the other parasites that have long sucked the blood out of our country. The bauxite industry is practically no more. The banana industry is killed thanks to Bill Clinton and his administration and the other big banana companies. And there's a whole lot of things going for us. So when I look at what is happening to Puerto Rico, I wonder, how far down the road is Jamaica and many of these other Caribbean countries? Because if you're borrowing all this money to build these structures, that is not going to be facilitating the poor folks down there that has no jobs to be able to maintain a decent lifestyle. And so who are they building these things for? Who is the island being developed for?
Well,
that is something that is not being discussed in our communities.
But you've answered your own question. I want to return first to the nomenclature here, the words that are used.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to change the expression underdeveloped or undeveloped countries to mean, we should say, super exploited countries. These are not underdeveloped. I mean, the history of the entire Caribbean,
yes,
is that people were doing just fine. They
mm-hmm.
provided for all their needs, and they were taking care of business, and they lived a very nice life.
Mm-hmm.
Until, of course, we found that people decided that we just go wherever it is we need to go and conquer lands and kill off the people, take their land and do what we want with it. We want what's in the land, on the land, over the land, around the land, and we'll just take everything. So a lot of these undeveloped or underdeveloped countries are really super exploited countries. And we have to begin to insist that that's what it is. These are super exploited countries. Why? Because as small as they are, they make up a substantial sector of emerging markets. And Puerto Rico is a good example. The more Puerto Rico has no real political destiny, except that it is a colony of the United States. It's part of the emerging market for the United States, the economic sector. So as long as Puerto Rico remains a self-undetermined, it remains perfectly exploitable, and debt is the best kind of exploitation, because to service the debt, you have to put up collateral. What is the collateral? The land and everything on it, over it, around it. Do you see what I mean? So this is the continuing pattern, and it's nothing new. This is what colonialism was all about, imperialism is all about. The acquisition by force and then by political control of the assets and resources and people of other countries. So this is not about, well, you know, what is happening in Jamaica? It's been happening since the 1400s. So it's just taking a, perhaps a little different thing here. All these bridges and roads that you're talking about being constructed in Jamaica, well, you should know that it is not because Jamaicans determined that these things are necessary. It is because the sector of construction, which is offshore, principally these days in the entire Caribbean, it's from China. China has a need to provide employment for Chinese laborers and workers. So, because they have heft, political heft, international clout, because they have money and can finance these projects, they look to places where they can initiate these projects. And with the initiation of these projects, they bring in their own workers. They bring in their own machinery. So that Jamaica becomes an incubator for the Chinese solution to their problem. In the process, we have, for example, I was born in Trinidad, we have in Tobago, you could barely recognize Tobago as Tobago. We have signage in Japanese and German. A little island. That little speck of dust in the Caribbean Sea, Trinidad, is not, the economy is not controlled by Trinidad. And yet it is the fifth largest oil refining country in the world. Now, how do you explain the anomaly there? Trinidadians should want for nothing. But this is what it looks like when we talk about underdeveloped. It means it's super exploited. And that requires cooperation. And some cases, they have no choice. How are you going to resist or fight against the domination of these big powers that have their army and air force and military to enforce their will? You can't. Unless you have a government, going back to the days, and I'm going back to your reference again, specifically of Jamaica, the formation of a Caribbean market that holds strong. You cannot sell, Jamaica cannot sell its sugar by itself. It has to be sold through Britain. Britain controls everything Jamaica makes, every ounce of sugar. And now the Chinese have bought up all of the sugar estates practically. Am I right or wrong? This is what is happening. So when you hear these things, it's a very intricate plan. And they look to parts of the world that they consider completely dispensable. Its people are dispensable. Its environment and ecology are expendable. Its resources, however, are desirable because they can all make money for some foreign entity. This is the story all over the world. The relationship between powerful nations and small nations that have no way to defend themselves and still incomprehensibly will not work toward the formation of a unified economic front. That's the dilemma. You have governments that are just not responding in an enlightened way to what is going on. Right now we have the phenomenon of Barbados. It's just only 12 miles wide, really. A small island. But it cannot feed itself because The pristine land is devoted to tourism. Foreign investment is encouraged, even though it's not necessarily warranted. But you can't feed yourself. There are fewer and fewer fish in the sea because all of that waste is going into the oceans, the pristine oceans, poisoning the fish, killing them off. But, you know, you have the picture you see all the time, the local black bartender and waiter serving you cocktails on the beach. And for that, you have to sacrifice your whole island and your way of life, which was perfectly fine some years ago. That's called progress, by another definition. So this is the dilemma. This is what you're referring to. And I think we have to begin to reverse these terms that we use when we say this is an underdeveloped or undeveloped country. When you look historically, you see that the people historically were able to provide for themselves. They developed their own technology appropriate to what they needed. They had their own economic system. It may not have been sophisticated compared to other societies, but it worked. Somebody decided, hey, rather than pollute our environment, let's go over there and pollute theirs. Thanks, Jose, for calling. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. The number to call is 888-874-4888. Henry from Chicago, what do you got to say? Henry, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Okay. I was getting worried there for a minute.
Oh, I was saying hello like seven times, but I guess we just didn't connect initially. But how you doing today?
Pretty good, Henry. Thank you for asking.
All right. You know, it's an interesting thing that you were mentioning with the conversation you had with Jose, because I wanted to talk about language. About 2 weeks ago, I think you mentioned something about the word terrorist and
yes,
how we defined it and how it made you, how it makes you feel. Well, you know, the thing about that word, you know, it's being used loosely among mainstream media, and it's being used for a purpose because of the fact that, you know, I think I mentioned this before, that mainstream media is basically they're like the marketing company for imperialism, colonialism, white supremacy, whatever ism, negative isms that you can think of, to make the population think of, you know, to give the population one thought that they can, you know, brainwash the people with. Terrorism, basically, to me, it's a word that typically is supposed to instill fear in people, because it, you know, the root word is terror, which means, you know, fear in the English language. But, you know, when I think about it, and, you know, you think about these words and think about how other words get used interchangeably, or they get replaced, like, you know, you were talking about underdeveloped, you know, compared to the real meaning of what those countries are. You know, you look at the origins of the English language, and we all know English is basically a bastardized language that takes its words from, you know, from other languages. And so you can use those things to your advantage, especially when, you know, when you have a group of people who don't totally understand, or don't, you know, they don't want to do the historical research behind these words that they're using. And so, you know, when you start hearing, you know, these what I call buzzwords, you know, your antennas are supposed to go up, and I always ask the question, okay, why is mainstream media presenting, you know, this situation like this? You know, what is the purpose behind them doing this? And most of the time, it's not something that's going to benefit me, you know, and it's not going to, you know, give me a positive image of people who may look like me or may associate with me. And for what reason, you know, why, you know, you have to look deeper into why they're doing certain things. And it's always a political purpose behind certain things. And, it's always, you know, like you always tell us, you know, you always have to watch the media defensively. You know, like I said, I'm always labeled a pessimistic. But you know what? The thing is that I don't care. You know, it's just harder to brainwash me than certain people.
But you're alert. You're alert because you recognize, because this is one of the tools of survival, because the attack is always, and it's consistent, and it's constant. The battle is for the mind. In any major system, this is what is calculated as part of the power equation. You have to have some way of controlling people's mindsets. Why? Because the way you think is likely to inform the way you act. So if they want you to act in a particular way, they send you or give you messages and so-called information and news that would inform you, in their favor, so that in turn your actions will be very much in line with what they predict you will do.
Mm-hmm. So
this is a major role of media, and we've seen it in this election in ways that, you know, I think are just ironclad cases against the media as tools of the power elite. There is no reason that the country should not be aware of all of the scandals relating to the Clintons, and that should inform voters going into this general election.
Mm-hmm.
It is not that you have a vendetta. It is that this is a valuable and valid part of what the media should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
exactly.
Just yesterday, I don't know if you listened yesterday, but we talked about Nigeria, the Clinton connection to Nigeria. We talked before about the Clinton connection to Haiti and Honduras and places like that. And the list goes on. And yet, the African-American community is solidly for Clinton. You wonder what the heck is going on here.
That is so weird.
The media's doing its job.
The Nigerian thing was actually new to me, but what we talked about in the past with Haiti and Libya, that should be enough for you to make your decision on why Hillary Clinton isn't qualified to be the president. So, you know, the Nigerian thing was just something extra that should put the cake on, you know, put the topping, you know, on why you should not support, you know.
Or what you should know. I mean, this is stuff you should know. This is stuff that is on the record. This is stuff you ought to know. If the media is doing its job, the average voter should be aware that these things have cropped up in her past. And for the last 30 years, there have been at least one major scandal per year. That has been hounding this woman, and yet they managed to escape. It's amazing.
Yeah, Utrecht, I want to ask you one more thing. I've been wondering. I would have wanted to get your opinion on this because over the last couple of months, the O.J. Simpson thing has resurfaced in entertainment and sports information. You know, they just recently had like a little TV series on FX, and then ESPN did a documentary on the O.J. Simpson case. And what I got out of it was they're telling us that black people do not have the capability of fairly judging or making a coward decision on certain things. And I thought that was a bunch of bull crap, you know, at first, because, you know, when people talk to me and tell me how the American justice system was broken because OJ, you know, got off, I always tell people, The American justice system wasn't broken in that case. It's never been broken because the American justice system was always about race. It's always been about race. And so to me, I always felt that the American justice system worked the way it was supposed to work. But, you know, outside of OJ possibly getting paroled next year, why do you think that they're bringing this back up again?
Well, to prevent that from happening, the idea is to make an example of O.J. Simpson, to make sure that he dies in prison. And if he even prevails and he's released, to make it so that his life will not be worth living, that he would have no way, no chance in hell to make a living and resume a decent life. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think America has really dealt with what really is the symbolism of this case, the significance of this case.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't deal with it, but it will deal with it only by implication and inference, but mm-hmm. never a direct discussion about it.
Yeah, because they don't want to admit that the justice system was never broken.
It has nothing to do with the justice system. I hate to tell you.
Yeah, well, the justice system is never about justice. That's why it's kind of strange to call it the justice system because it's never about justice and it's never about truth.
This is a case that really is about the primordial foundation of America as a social construct. I know it sounds kind of, you know, fuzzy, but what it says is this case came to symbolize the unspoken fears in America and the unspoken anger and rage in America and the very thing that is at the root of life in America. On the surface, it is a straightforward case.
Mm-hmm.
Did he kill his wife and Ron, I can't remember his last name at the moment, who had come to deliver a pair of sunglasses to his ex-wife and was there and was killed along with her in the most brutal way. But this is not about murder.
Mm-hmm.
This is about a deep-seated problem about sexual contact between a black male and a white female. And you have, when you look at the body of law, of laws in this country, having to do with just that, and the things deriving from that, sexual contact, sexual relationships between black men and white women, all these things that happen, really horrible things, lynchings, that's part of it, mass killings, the Klan, all of these things, the idea of miscegenation, and things that are seen by the white supremacist world as threats to racial purity. And here you had a man who, in effect, had won a prize. He had won the prize of a white wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then he murdered her. This is a deep-seated psychological reaction that came to, in my view, symbolize the crux of this case. A murder case, you can see that as a basic thing. But everybody understood what was on the underside of this case. In this country, it will not be allowed, it still has not been allowed, that a white man can be convicted of raping a black woman. It's just not allowed. Because in the eyes, not just so much of the law, in the eyes of the law, that shouldn't be allowed. But in the deep-seated recesses of a white supremacist society, a black man should not ever be allowed sexual contact, let alone sexual contact that ostensibly leads to violence, murderous violence. But in the case of, let's say, Tawana Brawley, here's a black teenager alleging that she was raped by not one, but six men, all of whom were white. One was an assistant district attorney. One was a part-time police officer who turned up murdered because the feeling was he was about to talk. But the law just would not allow this to happen. The Attorney General of New York State himself spoke to me in an exclusive interview. I went down and asked him about this case. Most of the legal questions he would not answer. He designated one of six people in the room to answer, or they decided to answer these questions, because he clearly was not conversant with the law. So he said to me, it would have been better if Tawana were found dead.
Wow.
That's what he said. I wrote it.
Wow.
But this tells you how deep this thing is. I think people have missed the whole point of the O.J. Simpson case. It was not just, in the strictest sense, a murder case. But it was speaking directly to America's history and this obsession with the black man's penis, I'm sorry to say. That's what it is. You look at the body of law. I mean, it's amazing how many laws in the United States concern themselves with this particular thing of the sexual contact between black males and white females. And what was allowed to happen. It is not accidental that in lynchings, what they routinely did was remove the genitalia of black men. I think somebody should do a psychological treatise on this thing, and I'm not being flippant about it. This, to me, represents a huge factor in the psychological orientation of the society and its origins that continue to be felt to this day. You look at any situation where there has been contact between white men and black men and white women, you see a huge difference in the treatment of these cases as opposed to other cases. And that's why I think all we are seeing is sensational. It's a football star, a high-profile person. It's the crime of murder. It's got sex. It's got drugs. It's got the lifestyle. It's got all of that stuff that the U.S. media would super simplify because that's what people want to see, they think. But when you talk about this case, I think within the proper context of it, you really get to understand what this case is about. And the case is about that root cause of troubles that we are continuing to have today. This whole notion, even within a murder case, white supremacy. You see it plainly. We had a white supremacist detective, what's his name? The one who routinely used the N-word. And he was called a racist, and he was shown to be a racist. But he continues to make a living as a kind of legal consultant, Mark Furman. It's an amazing thing. But that's how life goes in the good old U.S. of A. So whenever you see this case again, try looking at that angle of it. And look at the, if you have a chance, just look at some of the cases in the United States that became sensational because they involved sexual contact between people of so-called different races, unquote. Thanks, Henry. Good to hear from you. Let's talk to David from Brooklyn. You're on the air, David. Hello? David is gone. 888-874-4888. We have Harvey from Berkeley. Hello, Harvey.
Hello, more than wonderful, Utrice. How are you today?
Hello, how are you doing?
Very good,
What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, everything all the time, all at once. But I'd like to talk about genetically modified foods, since we are what we eat. And excuse me. And if you look up, if you Google, that's where I do all my research. I Google things. So the first one is GMO foods and cancer. And it turns out that it says here that GMO foods are connected with breast cancer. And it's really, there's a lot of articles on that. So that's number one. And then secondly, Google the words, excuse me, GMO foods and obesity. And it says GMO encourages weight gain and obesity. They found that obesity really started climbing from when they introduced GMO foods. But the worst one here is it says, also Google this, it says GMO lab rats will not reproduce after third generation. And the study finds that GMO corn makes rats infertile, but regular corn doesn't cause sterility. So this may be some sort of population modification thing. That maybe that's why that's what they don't want us to know. And I suggest that we all start our own gardens if possible, using using non-GMO seeds. The White House kitchen is organic, and organic, of course, means non-GMO, but most processed foods have some form of GMO product in them, ingredient in them. So I find that I myself have cut wheat, corn, white rice, and sugar out of my diet. Those are mostly all genetically modified, and I save a lot of money now. I just buy organic food, and even though organic's a bit more expensive, I really do save a lot of money in the overall realm of things, and I feel that's the way to go, because basically we're organic beings, and I think we have to eat organic food. And so I say, OMG, it's GMO. Let's get back to organic.
OMG, oh my God. It's GMO. It's funny, but it's not. It's very serious at the same time. I was reading that report too. It popped up in the news about GMO foods and the relationship between GMO foods, according to certain studies, and obesity and cancer, the incidence of cancer. Let me ask you: could it not be the case? Do you feel it's the case? I should say that the attacks on GMOs, GMO foods, are supposed to be, according to the other side, these are supposed to be funded in order to inculcate a sense of fear in the consumer population. And ultimately, the plan is to impact the economy and agribusiness in general. What do you think about that?
Well, It's so difficult to say, because first of all, all the products used with GMO, all the glyphosate and all the other Monsanto products, they actually are ruining not only are they ruining the people, but they get into the waterways, they get into the oceans. And you talked about degradation of the oceans and our rivers and lakes. It's just really I don't know what they, I don't know why they're doing it, and they want to hide it. And I think that it's really a pox on the people here. I don't understand quite the reason of it. Again, it might be population modification of some sort, because what our body, the way our body works, is that it wants nutrition. The millions and billions of cells and microorganisms in our body, what they want is real nutrition. So when you put in genetically modified foods, it might see that as a toxin, in which case, since we can't eliminate it fast enough, they would wrap it in a little bit of fat and store it somewhere. But it's seen as a toxin, and the body reacts with cancer, with obesity, and here with reproduction. So it really is, I don't understand the connection with money, but there may be higher levels of it that they don't want us to know about. And I feel that it's really detrimental, because essentially we've always eaten natural foods, which have come down through time, our connection with the natural world. And here suddenly they're playing with everything, and we're at risk for disease and death and all these things. You see how many people are obese these days. It's scary. They said that 40% of American women are obese now. And so I think that we really have to pay attention to what we eat. As I say, we are what we eat. So I would call on people to spend their money in the right way, maybe even encourage local community gardens and make sure the seeds are natural, not GMO. And so you'll save money, you'll save yourself, you'll save your health. And big industrialized farms, they all seem to go the GMO way. Like right now.
Sure, absolutely. No question about that.
Warren Buffett said that they're going to pull out, he owns a major stockholder in Coca-Cola, and most soft drinks have either used GMO sugar beet to sweeten them, or high fructose corn syrup, which is genetically modified corn. So they're going to, Coke is going to pull out of Vermont, because Vermont is going to start labeling its products.
We have to leave it there for today.
Okay.
We run out of time, but good to hear from you, and thank you always for the information you share with us. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, Teresa.
That brings us to the end of our program today. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And this is a long weekend. Just hang out with people who bring positive dimension to your life, and with great care, avoid people who don't. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other next week. Bye-bye.